Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a podcast for anyone keen to understand the effects of coronavirus on the world. My name is Ben Bland and I'm the director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Tom Tugendhat, who's the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the UK Parliament and a rising star in the ruling Conservative Party. I want to start by asking about your career, Tom. After studying theology and Islam at university, you worked in the City of London and served as a British Army officer in Iraq and Afghanistan. You were elected as an MP in 2015 and then chosen to chair the Foreign Affairs Committee in 2017. So maybe you can start by telling me, how did your military service shape your view of the world?
Well, I think the most important thing about it was that most military service these days is about cooperation. It's about how we work together with allies. I mean, obviously Australia, but the United States, with France, with Germany, with many countries around the world, and how we cooperate in trying to protect our interests and our allies and shape the world around us. I think that's really most of what I've taken away from soldiering.
So from that focus on cooperation, what made you want to move into the world of bickering that we like to call politics?
Well, politics is a team game too. I mean, it's a different way of structuring it. It's a competition of ideas, but it's certainly still a team game, and trying to make it work is it's a challenge.
And you're obviously someone who thinks a lot about your position, your role. At this early stage, relatively, in your political career, what do you hope to achieve as an MP and as a foreign policy advocate?
Crikey. I hope to have a decent career ahead of me, so I don't know what I'm going to achieve in years to come. But at the moment, I'm entirely focused on making sure that Britain's place in the world is secured, because I think the values that we're advocating, the ideas that we're calling for, are not only in Britain's interest, but in the interests of free people around the world. So, you know, I'm calling for a rethink on our relationship with China, a re-engagement with Europe, and a much bigger footprint in places like the Indo-Pacific, and a really strong bridge with countries like India. So there's a whole series of areas that I'm looking at in terms of Britain's place in the world, and I hope I'll get the chance to do it. Having been elected twice now to chair the Foreign Affairs Committee, I'm trying to exercise a bit of influence like that.
And in terms of Britain's place in the world, I think right now we can't disassociate that from the COVID-19 crisis that obviously has hit every country hard. It's been something of a harsh spotlight on our leaders and our political systems around the world. And I know from friends and family back home in London just how bad things are, unfortunately, at the moment, with a rampant second wave having prompted a new lockdown, the fifth highest death toll in the world in the UK, and a government that's really struggled, I think, to explain and to offer to the public a coherent strategy for how to get out of this. I mean, what's gone wrong? The NHS, the British government, the civil service obviously had a reputation for competence, for being at the cutting edge of health and science. How did this turn into such a fiasco?
Well, look, I think there's various things that have gone well and various things that have gone badly for all countries around the world. Many countries have struggled in different ways. Some have been luckier. I mean, some smaller, more isolated countries have found it easier, quite obviously, to cut off communications with the outside, and that will make a difference. But for countries like the UK, which are fundamentally crossroad nations, you know, where flights in and out of Heathrow are so frequent that before the COVID emergency, it was quicker than 1 a minute. So, you know, you're talking about an enormous amount of people who transit through, travel through, communicate through the UK. So this is a really big, you know, this is a really big issue. Now, that's one of the reasons why this has proved extremely challenging. And the reality is that we're going to have to find ways of rebuilding from it. But I think it's wrong to say that the UK has solely done badly out of this. If you look at, for example, the investment in the Oxford vaccine, now I don't know whether it's going to be the one that ends up working. I mean, as we know, there are three vaccines now that we know about, but the one that seems to be working well in a sort of room temperature or nearer to room temperature than the others is the Oxford AstraZeneca one. Now, if that proves to be successful, that is a hell of a success for the UK. And it's a hell of a success for UK's influence around the world, because this will be the vaccine that is much more likely to be usable in countries where the pressure of heat, frankly, is greater.
Do you think that's is the case then for the UK, that it may have gone badly into the crisis, but because of the strength of the pharmaceutical industry and other factors, the UK might be a kind of a leading country on the way out if we are hopefully, as it seems, kind of entering perhaps the beginning of the end of this crisis?
So I think it's too soon to tell. I mean, look, you know, there are many countries we thought were doing well at the beginning, and then they turned out not to be doing so well. You know, I think about countries like Germany or Sweden, who have had to, very sadly, had to reconsider some of their earlier positions. We look at some countries we thought we were doing incredibly badly, but seem to have recovered somewhat. Countries like Italy, who have reset in many ways the way they've dealt with this and have appear to be doing better than initially expected. You know, so I just think it's too early to tell who's done well and who's done badly. And then, of course, we've got some countries that have, well, we just don't know what the statistics are. It's just far too hard to know.
Yeah, certainly in the part of the world that I look at in Southeast Asia, there's the lack of clarity in a lot of countries about how bad the situation really is. So I think there's something in that. People have been rushing to judge and say, this is a massive accelerant of trends in the world, and we can see this is going to sort of turbocharge China's rise and US decline. But I think you're right to highlight that, you know, it is early on, and we've already been through a number of phases, and we're still in the first year of this crisis, and it could, you know, unfortunately, potentially drag on quite a bit longer.
Well, it could go on for a lot longer. Secondly, there isn't a vaccine yet, and we've got three promising candidates, but we don't know for certain which ones are going to be released yet. And so there is a concern still, and that means that we don't know exactly how the vaccination program is going to roll out and what that's going to mean for global economies or national economies. It doesn't mean we also don't know what it's going to mean for local healthcare provision or different national responses. So I'm just cautious that, you know, if we'd been having this conversation a year ago, neither of us would have been able to talk about COVID because we wouldn't have had a clue what we were talking about. It's less than 12 months later. Let's just wait and see a bit.
And in the midst of this pandemic, of course, I guess the other, one of many other big geopolitical challenges facing the UK is Brexit. The government's obviously been trying and struggling to seal a trade deal with the European Union before post-Brexit transition period ends on December the 31st. We're now in the final stages of something of a dangerous game of chicken, I guess. What's your sense in how this is going to end? Is this deal or no deal?
Well, look, I hope very much it will be. There will be an agreement. I mean, this is something that's fundamentally in the interests of everybody in Europe. And by the way, I would argue in many people around the world as well. And so I think this is one of those moments where I think, you know, we really should come to a deal. And, you know, I've been pretty clear about my own position on this. I'm sorry we're leaving the European Union. I think it's an error, but you know, that's a choice that's been made. And I think now what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that this is as smooth a transition as possible, because the purpose of government is not to experiment on its own people, but to create a stable platform from which businesses can grow. After all, it's the job of entrepreneurs to take risks, not the job of ministers. And I think that's something that sometimes governments need to remember. You know, the key here is that if we fail to get an agreement with the European Union, this will be a serious failure of statecraft on behalf of the British government and on behalf of the European Union.
You certainly would have to say that it's going to be hard for the UK to push these ideas about global Britain tilting to the Indo-Pacific, etc., and obviously finding new trade deals with Australia and many other countries in Asia, if the UK hasn't been able to seal a trusted and comprehensive deal with its neighbour, the European Union.
Well, look, in a particularly unusually undiplomatic moment recently, the Japanese trade minister said at a press conference with Liz Truss, our trade secretary, that the most important aspect of the trade deal that Japan was interested in was our agreement with the European Union. Now, that is a pretty blunt statement by a Japanese minister, who are normally extremely cautious. And so I think that tells you all you need to know. But look, I mean, anybody who's been climbing or anybody who's been has done any sort of serious project, you need a stable footing in your own in order to step off to other things. And whatever the agreement is with our European partners, we need to know what it is. And at the moment, you know, no deal isn't an end state. All it means is you've got to start the talks again the next day. So no deal is uncertainty. No deal is instability. It isn't a thing. It's an absence of a thing.
I just want to ask a bit more on Brexit. I know you said that you've come to accept it. Obviously, you were a supporter of Remain. But in some senses, you're the epitome, and I mean that in a good way, of a European cosmopolitan, a dual French-British national, I believe, with a French wife, a fluent French speaker, of course. You've obviously worked in different countries all around the world. I mean, to you personally, I mean, what will the reality of Brexit finally coming into force mean?
Well, on one level, it won't change anything. I mean, I will still go and see my in-laws in France, and you know, I don't believe it's going to make any sizable difference to that. As you rightly say, my wife is French, so it won't make a huge amount of difference if we, you know, were we ever to move there. But the reality is, I think it'll make a difference, if we're not careful, to a lot of people's lives, in the sense that we will forget that actually we have a huge shared history and partnership with our European friends and allies. Look, I mean, you know, Magna Carta was a document written by a French prince. It wasn't written by the English. It was written by a French prince to control French barons in an occupied English territory, or rather the other way around, by French barons to control a French prince in an occupied English territory. You know, we forget that the civil rights that we enjoy grew up in concepts of, you know, enlightenment that emerged out of Italy, that emerged out of the Judeo-Christian values that we share. And it's absolutely true that, of course, you know, those values we have exported. I mean, Australia is, of course, an epitome of that. But the truth is that we have a very strong connection to our European partners, and through that to many others. So it strikes me as an entirely sensible thing to do. I can understand why people didn't like the structure of the European Union. I can think of plenty of things to complain about it myself. But the idea that we can avoid having a relationship with those people who are 20 miles off our coast is unlikely to be true. We are going to, in some way, have to have a relationship. And, you know, with France, that relationship is certainly at the moment is one of our most important defence partnerships. With Germany, it's one of our most important intelligence partnerships. With all of them, it's a very important trading partnership. So, you know, how we work together is going to be a question for the next 20, 30 years. Whatever we do with the European Union. And there's an awful lot of work to do there on a bilateral basis, even if we ignore the EU altogether.
It's a big challenge, as you say. And you know, presuming, say, that there is a deal and some sort of reasonable partnership can be formed there. I mean, more generally, obviously, the government is likely to come out with a very ambitious integrated review into defence and foreign policy, pushing this idea of global Britain, a tilt to the Indo-Pacific, to Australia's part of the world. But at the same time, there's the economic pressures of coronavirus and the recession leading to a cut in the aid budget just in the last few days. So how realistic is it to have this tilt to the Indo-Pacific, to Asia, to advance this global Britain strategy when realistically there are just so many domestic issues right now?
Well, look, I think I think there are always global issues. I mean, the reality of life is that the world doesn't stand still just because you have issues at home. And so trying to find ways in which we're able to create a coalition that enables us to deal with the challenges that we find around the world is, I think, the point of government, frankly. And that's why I spend quite a lot of time speaking to mates in Australia like Andrew Hastie and many others. And I spend time speaking to guys in New Zealand and America and Canada, and of course also to people in Japan and France and Germany. I mean, you know, I think the point about government is that, as I say, your job is to create as stable a platform from which entrepreneurs and businesses can take risk, to create that stable platform from which they can jump. And then, you know, to see how it is that we can cooperate to make that a bigger and more prosperous base from which all others can succeed. And that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do.
And obviously, in terms of the global issues we're all facing, the obvious one that we need to talk about is China. Earlier this year, you set up a China research group of conservative MPs to try and focus attention on the way Beijing's rise is changing the world. But from a kind of particularly British perspective, if you like, what are the main challenges that China presents?
So there's a variety of challenges. I mean, some of them are really just structural. You know, what China is trying to do is quite understandable, which is trying to create a series of bilateral relationships that undermine an international distributed system. Now, that's challenging because actually countries like Britain, Australia, France, many others rely on a level of cooperation between partners that means that we have a very distributed power network in the world. There isn't, although the United States is quite clearly the world's military hegemon, in many ways the economic power is so distributed by the nature of the different economies around the world that it's very hard to say where the center is. There's various centers depending on what you're looking at. And I think that's one of the things that we've got to try and defend, whereas China is trying to centralize so many things on itself. Now, we see that through the Belt and Road Initiative. We see that through various investment programs, which some people have described as debt traps. We see that through many other areas where China is trying to reinforce native industries to 60 or 70 or 80% in certain sectors. And indeed, if you look at, I think I'm right in saying battery technology, China now dominates about 70%. I think I'm right in saying computers is about 80% and mobile phones about 90% of the global market. So we're seeing, you know, we're seeing a very strong centralization. That puts Britain in a difficult position, like everybody else, because you're seeing a monopolistic or rather certainly very market dominant position. But then you look at what's happening in the Indo-Pacific and you see the behavior towards Australia, when Australia stood up for the rights of Taiwan to be an observer on the World Health Organization. And you see that there's two things there. One is China is undermining our ability to have easy access to information about the successes against COVID that Taiwan achieved, because it's denying it the voice of the WHO that is so important. But two, it's also demonstrating, sadly, a very bullying attitude towards an important partner, and that's a lesson that is heard very clearly in London. You know, the behaviour towards Canberra is not ignored in Westminster.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think that the China challenge is clear in a sense. I guess the difficulty now is what to do about it. I mean, on one specific issue I'd like to ask you here is Hong Kong, a subject dear to my heart because I used to live there and read a book about young people and the protest movement against China's squeeze on Hong Kong's freedoms and autonomy. I mean, as the former colonial master in Hong Kong, what can the UK realistically do to actually help the people of Hong Kong? I know there's been this, you know, quite generous offer for British national overseas passport holders to be able to move to UK. That's good. That's done. But that doesn't really help the people who are struggling on in Hong Kong. So what realistically can you do against, you know, a superpower that's effectively taking away the rights of people on its own territory?
Well, that's a real challenge. And it's very hard to say, because the truth is, you know, the days of gunboats and of, you know, military diplomacy like that are long behind us, and there's absolutely no suggestion of it. What there is you know, a series of agreements that we struck in the 80s and then lodged with the UN, and you know, the Chinese are violating them. And I think it's a great shame, because I think that Hong Kong, as you know, Ben, was a in many ways the golden goose for much of the Guangzhou region, and gave an ability for China to have access to global capital in ways that allowed the Belt and Road Initiative and many other projects to prosper, because they were under a legal system that other people accepted. I mean, anybody who's had anything to do with the Chinese legal system will know that that's not an international legal system that many people will be happy to use, but Hong Kong was or is. And so I think, you know, there is a danger here that China is, you know, is killing the golden goose. I can see why they're doing it, because this is about control rather than economic prosperity, but still it's deeply concerning. The question really now is, what can we do? Not much is the honest answer. We can raise a voice and we can point out that Hong Kong is no longer in a one country, two systems, but in a one country, one system nation. We can change its custom status, and we can offer the people of Hong Kong the support that they need if they are able or willing to leave. And I hope Australia, Canada, and other countries will also offer, make a similar offer that Britain has done towards British nationals overseas. And I know that many people in many countries are looking at that quite seriously, because the industry and energy of Hong Kong is in its people, not in its geography. And so it's certainly a huge opportunity for many. But I think it's extremely sad that we're seeing the erosion of civil rights in a city-state that has been so long an example of economic prosperity to the world.
I want to turn this around slightly here, because as you said, I think earlier, I mean, China in a sense is doing what you would expect it to do as a rising power, and President and Party General Secretary Xi Jinping's assertive policies seem to be very popular. He's sort of been further entrenched in his position domestically, and he can't and won't be seen to back down in the face of Western pressure. So what do you think is the end game for the UK, for Australia, perhaps for a new Biden administration pushing back against China? Is there some sort of grand compromise that can be struck, or do we risk sort of inadvertently pushing towards, you know, from competition to real conflict at some point?
Well, look, I hope we don't get to that point, because I think, first of all, there's no need to. Secondly, there's every opportunity to avoid it. Look, what we want is pretty simple. We want the prosperity and happiness of the British people. And in order to achieve that, we need to have the prosperity and happiness of many people around the world, including the Chinese. But what we need to remember is that the Chinese people, 850 million of whom were lifted out of poverty in the last 20 or so years, were lifted out of poverty not by the communism that their leaders espouse. It was that communism that put them there through the Great Leap Forward in the Cultural Revolution. They were lifted out of poverty by the market economics that came to the country under Deng Xiaoping and when they joined the WTO and through further reforms. So, you know, this is a China that on one hand remembers where it's, you know, where its bread's buttered, if you like, and remembers the size of the economy, economic success that it's seen in recent years, because it's so clear. But on another side, you know, we see in General Secretary Xi a resistance to the societal reforms that are necessary to embed economic prosperity. Now, you know, what General Secretary Xi is doing is, I think, dangerous for Australia. I think it's dangerous for Japan. I think it's troubling for the United Kingdom. But most of all, it's concerning for the people of China, because it's embedding risk and instability within a system that depends on growth and trade.
Moving to the other great power of our times, President-elect Joe Biden has stated in his very back-slapping, square-jawed way that America is back after the unilateralism and chaos of the Trump era. Do you think President Biden can simply turn back the clock as if Trump's some sort of aberration? Or do you think something deeper has changed in the US, but also in how the US is seen in the rest of the world and its credibility?
Look, I think the US remains an essential partner to any of us who are on the side of the free world, frankly. And I don't think there's any great debate about that. I would be cautious about being too critical about everything that President Trump has done. If you look at the peace process in the Middle East and the relationship between Israel and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, you see that actually, you know, there was not zero success there. I think it was very, very hard to imagine that such a deal could have been achieved even 2 or 3 years ago, let alone when President Trump was elected. But I do think there is a huge opportunity for President Biden to tap the well of goodwill that people have for international cooperation to deal with struggles like, as you rightly identified, how do we help China to join the international system in a way that is cooperative rather than confrontational? And I think there's a very great opportunity for us to work together on that. There's a huge opportunity for us to remember the regulatory reforms that we need to see, and indeed how we struggle against climate change. So whether that's, you know, carbon pricing, or whether that's, you know, trade reform, I think there's a huge amount that we can work on.
And one of the interesting things about the relationship between the UK, Australia, the US, and Canada and New Zealand in the last few years is how the Five Eyes intelligence sharing relationship, which, you know, until relatively recently was actually a secret relationship in the shadows, has become almost, you know, something approaching a more formal alliance. Now we have Five Eyes foreign ministers' statements. Do you see this as a positive development? And do you think there's kind of further room to grow these relationships and have even more effective coordination on China and other key questions?
So look, I think the Five Eyes relationship is really interesting, because what it basically speaks to is a level of trust between nations that goes much deeper than whoever's in, you know, the White House or Kiribati House or whatever, or number 10 on any day, and to a fundamental level of confidence that each other's systems, that each other's peoples are partners and brothers and sisters. Because this is a really, in order to share the kind of intelligence we're sharing, you've really got to trust each other. And not just today, but for 20, 30, 40 years into the future. So it's a statement of confidence, not just a statement of presence. And I think that's really interesting. Now, how much of it becomes more of the sort of, you know, foreign secretaries speaking, making statements together, I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, there are many ways of doing that. And, you know, we have a quad system where our foreign and defense secretaries meet each other every year or two. And, you know, we do the same with many other countries around the world. And I think those things matter. But I think we should remember that the Five Eyes relationship is particularly special because of that confidence in each other's futures that it demonstrates. Now, I'm pretty keen that we look at countries around the world and see who else might be a suitable member. I'm keen to enter conversations with Japan. I'm not saying it's something that could be delivered, but I certainly think it's something that's worth exploring. If you look at, for example, South Korea, in many ways, South Korea already shares an awful lot of the intelligence that we produce, of course, because it's such a close ally with the United States. And, you know, so there are other opportunities around there, and our intelligence relationship with Germany is extremely close, and our intelligence relationship with Israel is extremely close. I suspect that Israel wouldn't be interested in joining because it's much more because it has its own national priorities. But, you know, there are many ways of looking at this relationship.
Okay, and just lastly, I want to come back to where we started, which is your career. We've just seen the former head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee elected U.S. president. The head of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the German Bundestag is running for the chancellorship. So what's next for the chairman of the UK Foreign Affairs Committee? Do you also aspire to attain the highest office in the land?
Look, I got into politics because I wanted to change my country and I wanted to change the way we act abroad. So I'm going to go for the biggest voice I can have to make sure that the policies that I think defend the prosperity and happiness of the British people achieve the greatest effect. So it's hardly surprising to see that my very, very good friend Röttgen and Joe Biden want to have a similar impression. Why else would you run for the chairmanship of your National Foreign Affairs Committee if it's not to have a voice on the world stage and to try and change the policies of your countries and to defend the interests of your people?
Well, thanks, Tom, for joining me for today's discussion. COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhart, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of upcoming podcasts. You can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and stay tuned for our next episode.